Without further ado, I'll introduce Duncan Rawlinson and Michelle Cater. Duncan is a principal of Towers Perrin, and Michelle is a consultant with the same group, both based in the Sydney office. Between them, they have first-hand experience of product strategy and development, retirement income product design and pricing, product innovation within the annuity sector, design of derivatives-based retail investment products, equity-released product design and pricing, modelling and financial management of complex financial product guarantees. Prior to joining Towers Perrin, Duncan was the head of product strategy and development in the UK for an insurance and investment subsidiary of Lloyds Bank. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Duncan Rawlinson.
Thanks, Anthony. Please shout at the back if you have trouble hearing me. I'll try and project my voice suitably. Just a quick introduction. The way we're going to run this, we'll talk for hopefully no more than 25 minutes, preferably only 20. We've got a fair number of slides to cover, but this is no more than an overview of the paper. So it probably works best if you've read the paper. Failing that, it certainly works better if you've got the paper with you. It's quite a detailed paper. It's been up for about 2 weeks now, so hopefully a few of you have had a chance to at least flick through it. Michelle will talk for the first half or so, and then I'll come back in. And I thought it was particularly topical that, given the subject matter of the paper, that we were slotted for the graveyard slot after lunch. I hope, despite the dessert, you do manage to keep awake, and we will be rattling through these slides fairly quickly, so hopefully that'll help as well. So, Michelle, over to you.
So, with a lot of new products entering the market, both here and overseas, which are designed to address longevity risk, what we wanted to take a look at is what the nature of that longevity risk is. So for that reason, a key theme of the paper is the random statistical uncertainty that an allocated pensioner has, not the parameter risk that's the greater concern for the annuity provider. So that is, what is the distribution, what's the shape, what's the expected longevity. But for the pensioner, there's the binary risk. I think in a presentation I attended earlier, they're either alive or they're dead. So for that pensioner, they're not looking at the norm, they're looking at what their binary risk is. So how we've approached this is we've done some stochastic projections. For an allocated pensioner who might think that they don't meet the norm, the best estimate case might not actually give them the information that they need to address the question of how long their pension is going to last. So we've done some stochastic projections to try and look at some of the distribution around that question. I'm not going to spend too much time on each of these charts. One reason is time. The other is I've had a couple of Sudafeds, so I'm probably going a bit quick. Going fast. For all those people who've had rum, it's probably a deep disadvantage. So what this chart is showing is this is one of the case studies from the paper. All of these chart references are charts from the Appendix B of the paper, so you can actually get all of the information, the underlying assumptions. But just briefly, we've approached this with taking a level income of $35,000 a year, which is indexed at CPI. And that level income is starting with your age pension and what you're eligible for from the age pension. And then the remainder is made up from a drawdown from the allocated pension. With this particular case study, one key point is that we've indexed the age pension to CPI plus 2%, which is just a proxy for the NTAWE indexation, which currently applies. And in this particular case, it's a 50% growth. So one thing to note here is where this is showing from the 5th to the 95th percentile. And one thing to draw your attention to is just in the 5th percentile, you can see it runs down at in the 19th and 20th year, whereas in the 50th, we're talking about year 28, 29. And the reason I point that out is on the next chart, we can see here too, this is just the allocated pension piece of the total income. So this is the drawdown from the allocated pension. It is not the total income that the pensioner in this stochastic projection receives. And we can see again, it's running out in 20 and 21. Which is an interesting point on this chart, because even though on the previous chart you can see that the allocated pension, particularly in the fifth percentile, does actually run out over the projection period, it's not actually noticeable on this total income chart. You can see that it does dip down just a little bit in the 1920 year in the fifth percentile, but not significantly, which sort of leads you to wonder whether or not what is really the longevity risk. Based on these projections, and they're a case study, and they assume, you know, a difference between total income and age pension indexation, but if a pensioner can draw a fairly level income from their allocated pension plus age pension relatively confidently, where is the longevity risk? On the next slide, this is one, if you have looked at the paper, we did note in there that we did look at the deflated total income. This is just showing, I think we mentioned in the paper, we looked at it, wasn't particularly interesting. This is because if you're drawing a level income index at CPI and you deflate to CPI, you come back to the level income. So not particularly exciting there. So one of the issues, obviously, is these charts might be one way to give an allocated pensioner a good idea of some of their risk. You know, in the fifth percentile, you might actually run out of your percent, your allocated pension in year 19 or 20. But, you know, on the off chance that pensioners aren't too familiar with interpreting stochastic charts, which is potentially unlikely, we think there's probably potentially a better way to present it to a pensioner. And this is one way of bringing the information that we've presented in those stochastic charts and bringing that together with the longevity projections and trying to give advisors a way perhaps that they can present to an allocated pensioner some information that helps them make decisions around their retirement planning. So over these, on the two right-hand columns, we have 50% growth assets and a 30% growth assets. These two columns could be 50% growth assets. They could be, you know, 50% of your investment in an allocated pension, 50% in a lifetime annuity. They could be various combinations of things. But the way that we would imagine this would be presented is by saying to an allocated pensioner, you know, you have a 3 and 4% chance or 25% chance or 75% chance, I should say, of being alive at dying before 92. So 25 of being alive at 92. You have a 60%, 8% chance that your fund will be depleted by that age if you invest in 50% growth assets. Is that something that you're comfortable with? You know, 25% chance you'll be alive, but, you know, only a 34% chance you'll have an allocated pension to draw from. Is that what you're comfortable with? Or do we need to look at a different way to structure this? Or would you like to invest? Or perhaps 30% growth assets is a better scenario for you. The other thing to note on this is in the age, in that the column where we present the age, rather than saying to a pensioner, you know, your expectation of life is 84 or is whatever, saying you have a 95% chance of being alive at age 66 and you have a 5% chance of being alive at age 100. Or alternatively asking them, how well do you think, and what are you in good health? Are you in poor health? You know, how do you feel that whether or not these ages should be adjusted up or down? And then will you have a pension around at the time that you think you'll be alive till? So giving them some kind of context around whether they'll be, you know, what their chances of being alive are and what the chances of having an allocated pension to draw down at that age. So that's what this was intended to get at. And then we've also, in the paper, looked at we've done some sensitivity around this. And this particular sensitivity is if we're indexing both the annual income target and the age pension at CPI. And you can see in this case is just the projected account-based pension, and it just runs off earlier because you're drawing more from that pension. And we can see in this case if there is no gap between the indexation of the allocated pension and the age pension, then in fact you do see a drop down in the total income that wasn't obvious earlier when there's a gap. And in this scenario, this is if there is a 25,000 flat pension. So in this case, the annual income target is not being indexed to CPI. And there is a gap again between the indexation of the total income and the age pension. And where this is interesting, again, on the next page, we're looking at the total income. And again, we see that it's flattened out. What is interesting about this is the account balance that this is based on is $150,000. So what this might suggest is that if you have $150,000 allocated pensions, you're eligible for all of the age pension. Where is your incentive to not really game that? You can achieve a level income with the age pension, is what this is suggesting. So perhaps you should invest in 100% risky assets and just, you know, see how it works out for you, because on this projection, you're actually ending up with a fairly stable income just with the age pension and a small account balance. Granted, it is $25,000 flat, so most people aren't going to be satisfied with that non-indexed to age 100, but it's an interesting visual. So what are the implications of this for the advice process? One thing that we sort of noted looking at the flat projections, or the flat total income stochastic projections, is that perhaps if the current gap between the indexation of CPI and the indexation of the age pension continues, you could argue that longevity risk is actually being transformed in part into political risk, that the indexation of the age pension will actually change. Because in actual fact, you can achieve on a projection an indexed total income of $35,000 with no loss, even in the fifth percentile case. Another implication is the importance of assessing the risk by reference to the retiree's attitude to risk. So I've focused on whether or not the retiree feels that they're in good health or poor health, or whether or not they might be happy that there's a 34% chance their allocated pension would be depleted. And that's an important thing. If they have a 25% chance of being alive, asking the question, what chance do you want of there being an allocated pension at that age? And presenting the information to them in terms that they can actually understand. Another important implication is the cost of the more effectively weighing up the merits of new forms of investment guarantees. So we could actually, it's possible to reproduce these numbers, and as I mentioned earlier in the table, your 50% gross assets could be some other combination of investment planning, and you can compare two different investment plans and have different cases. So your 68% chance, if we introduce a guarantee or if we introduce a part lifetime annuity, this 68% could actually be 95%. Does that more closely meet your needs? So the idea is to present complex information in a way that retirees who are not retired actuaries can actually understand. And the other important point is that for AFS licensees who have risks associated with the advice that they give, because they have requirements about how they have advice and what kinds of considerations they need to have put into presenting that advice. And it's a better management of that if this information is made available to a retiree. And with that, I'll hand over to Duncan.
Thanks, Michelle. There were very much two parts to this paper. That first part, for those of you who were in Darren Wickham's session earlier this morning, I was one of them. I think you'll immediately notice that there are some interesting overlaps between some of the things that Darren and Richard were looking at and some of the things we've looked at thus far. We've ultimately ended up in similar territory, but choosing to present some things in a slightly different way. But maybe between the two presentations, there's an optimum solution in there somewhere. But the paper, we went on to look at something really quite that builds on some of this analysis, but is really getting into quite a different point, and is much more a point relevant in as much in a product development context as it is an advice context. And I just want to take you through that now. We spend a bit of time in the paper developing what we a term that we call the survivor risk premium, and we've looked at this in a number of ways. But fundamentally, we were asking ourselves the question, how rational is the decision at retirement to not purchase a lifetime annuity? I guess particularly a pertinent question given one of the questions to the Minister a minute ago. The paper does recognise there's no free lunch in any of this. There's a cost where there's risk to be borne. There's a cost associated with that risk. There isn't some magic outcome from choosing an allocated pension versus a lifetime annuity or vice versa. So I'm not going to labour the no free lunch debate, and that's dealt with in the paper. What I did want to get onto was really just drawing out some of the key things in this part of the paper. The survivor risk premium, in its simplest form, where we started was to think of it as just the extra cost. If I have a choice today of at age 60 of buying a lifetime annuity or deferring that purchase for a year and buying it at age 61, the survivor risk premium is the extra cost of that A61 adjusted for obviously the fact that there's a difference of 1 year income. So leaving that to one side, it's essentially just the added cost of surviving that extra year, and by having deferred the purchase of an annuity, the cost associated with missing out on the benefit of acquiring an annuity 1 year and surviving the year, in other words, sharing in the reserve that is left behind by people who are unfortunate to die too early. We looked at a simplified assessment of that survivor risk premium and thought, well, actually, what does this tell us about decisions between allocated pensions and lifetime annuities, and from that, what might it tell us about innovations in the allocated pension space, particularly around development of guaranteed benefits in retirement? Now, the simplified assessment of the survivor risk premium is simplified. It ignores a number of things. It ignores the utility that a retiree derives from the allocated pension in terms of the fund balance being repaid on death. It does assume the survival from 1 year to the next. And we also only chose to look at it on a deterministic basis. But we then made it more complicated by basically dealing with all of those things, removing the implicit assumption of survival, recognising the utility associated with the death benefit, and then, for good measure, introducing stochastic investment returns. Now, in all of these, there is a need to adjust for difference in fees between products. We have certain assumptions in the paper. Don't have a particular axe to grind. People will have different assumptions, but the paper does reflect a higher fee in an allocated pension versus what I would term the implicit fee or spread in the pricing of a lifetime annuity, and that does have a bearing on some of what you're about to see. So this was the simplified presentation first. Blue line, the curved blue line, is the survivor risk premium, and no surprises to any of us, that increases essentially with age. So what we've got here is a projection year. This is for someone who started age 60, so progressive years of retirement. That survivor risk premium is increasing year on year. We then have two horizontal lines. The top line is the deterministic expected risk premium for a portfolio that is 50% invested in growth assets. So what this is showing is the outperformance of that portfolio relative to risk-free, adjusted for the difference in fees between the two products. There is the second horizontal line. The lower one is then using a 30% exposure to growth assets. If I just focus on the top horizontal line first, simplistically, what this is saying to me anyway is that it appears to be a very rational decision to choose an allocated pension at retirement. Whether it remains a rational decision to stay in an allocated pension throughout retirement, well, we'll come back to that on future slides. But at first blush on this, there's at least a question against that. Why? Well, there are a number of things going on here. It's partly the difference in fees. It is also because of the increasing rate at which the survivor risk premium grows. So think of it as a bet year on year. Each year I'm asking myself the question, should I stay where I am in my allocated pension, or should I take the bet that I will survive the next year, or should I lock into a lifetime annuity? And I know this is simplistic, and we make it more complex in a minute. So the interesting thing here, though, is, and this echoes a point that Darren made this morning, but in a slightly different way, that there's a crossover for the 50% exposure to growth assets. There's a crossover point on this chart. But for 30% exposure to growth assets and allocated pension, there is no crossover. So purely looking at financial risks, and there are other issues to contend with, but purely looking at financial risks, it maybe raises the question, well, actually, if one makes one's chooses too conservative an investment strategy within the allocated pension, it struggles to hold its head above water relative to an alternative choice that might be made. Now, again, this is a simplistic assessment, so let's look at a more complex one. This does two things. It looks worse than it is. There are two curves that run from, well, the dark blue and the light blue curves. The paper looks at progressive stages of making the survivor risk premium more complex. The dark blue curve is, I think, relaxing the assumption of survival. What it does is it extends the survivor risk premium. It makes it increase at a slower rate. The light blue curve is then saying, well, actually, we're not comparing apples with apples when we compare a lifetime annuity with an allocated pension, because there is a clear loss for a lifetime annuitant or their estate in buying one and then dying the following year. So what we tried to introduce was a risk-neutral comparison of the two products. And the way we chose to do that was to look at a lifetime annuity with a fairly contrived guarantee period in it. And that gives you the light blue survivor risk premium curve on this chart. It's basically a curve which has a guarantee, all the same principles as before, but with the lifetime annuity having a guarantee period to roughly the life expectancy. The other charts then on here are the quartiles of investment, stochastic investment returns, again adjusted for the difference in fees, arrived at from choosing the allocated pension and the risk premium that one might achieve and forbearing investment risk relative to a risk-free choice. And so you get a similar picture to the earlier chart, but the metrics are quite different in here. So probably the key thing to focus on is if you look at the light blue curve and the light green middle curve, they cross over at about the high 70s. Now, to me, what that's saying, well, it raises a number of questions. The key one is that it does seem to reinforce quite sensibly the choice that, at least from a financial point of view, choice that individuals are making at the point of retirement. But again, whether it remains sensible from a financial point of view to remain in an allocated pension invested in this way throughout retirement, well, maybe the jury's still out on that. But there are lots and lots of conclusions that one could draw from this. We highlight a few in the paper, but just to pick up on a couple here, it does strike us that the decision not to purchase a lifetime annuity might be quite rational for a retiree at the point of retirement because of that distribution of, if you like, the portfolio returns, their excess returns relative to the survivor risk premium, relative to the threshold that return has to beat to warrant staying in the allocated pension. But the retiree should think perhaps more seriously about locking into something that is more risk-free in its nature and does more for the retiree in terms of longevity risk at some point during retirement. The more risk-averse the retiree, the more the scales perhaps tilt in favour of a lifetime annuity. The higher the fee difference between the two products, again, the more the scales tilt in favour of a lifetime annuity. And perhaps for a very risk-averse investor, there's a question as to whether an allocated pension might be a suitable home at all. I know we could debate that at some length. But even where, and this is, an extremely important point for retirees, that access to lump sums, flexibility, all the other things that we draw out in the paper as being reasons for choosing an allocated pension, although those things may be important, what this analysis does is highlights the extent to which that opportunity cost associated with retaining that flexibility by staying in an allocated pension. Well, sorry, that's the other chart in the paper, which is then looking at the same thing, but looking at the 30% exposure to growth assets in the allocated pension. Message pretty much the same as before. The crossover points come earlier. The more risk-averse one is, the harder it becomes to beat the survivor risk premium. Well, so what? Well, For us, there were a few implications from this. In short, I think it's about better satisfying a reasonable basis of advice test. A key theme really for us in approaching this paper was whether any of this should have a more defined role in the advice process than our understanding of the role that it currently has. And again, there are lots of different ways of presenting this information, not getting too hung up on the way we've chosen to present it. But I've seen in statements of advice, what I would describe as extremely cursory comparisons of lifetime annuities versus allocated pensions. Not here to promote lifetime annuities, but when we think about adding guaranteed benefits and particularly guaranteed income benefits to allocated pensions, to my mind, those issues become extremely important to convey. The paper makes the point that judging investment risk by reference to a more relevant return benchmark, being the survivor risk premium, is as important, if not more important, than the traditional measures of investment volatility. And again, that's probably slightly different, but a related theme to a theme Darren was picking up on this morning. It also highlights, as I mentioned earlier, the opportunity cost and risk of the flexibility offered by an allocated pension. As Michelle mentioned earlier, these tools, to my mind, provide mechanisms for more effectively weighing up the merits, both costs and benefits, of new forms of guarantees within allocated pensions. But most importantly, if retirees are going to make the decisions they make, these sorts of techniques, it seems to us, better inform the decisions that a retiree chooses to make. We talked about the better management for AFS licensees of managing the risks associated with the advice process, but these are quite complex. These decisions are quite complex. The information to convey is complex. I actually see quite a positive from that. The positive is about supporting and cementing the value of an advisor in the advice process throughout retirement, not just at the point of retirement. The paper then goes on to look at products. Big matrix of products put in the paper, which basically are conveying all sorts of products that are in the retirement income stream space around the globe. Essentially, there are pretty much only two products in that matrix which are in Australia at the moment. I think there's a lot of interest in guaranteed minimum benefits. Guaranteed minimum benefits within the income phase of an allocated pension, and that's in the chart there. But at the moment, the lion's share of Australian businesses, everyone will appreciate, is really the top right in this matrix. There's a little bit of business sold in the bottom left, but there's very few products offered, Asteron product being one exception, elsewhere in this matrix. Well, so what? Well, the paper draws out some themes, really, for product providers, to my mind. What does this analysis imply for the optimum mix at and during retirement between non-guaranteed allocated pensions, embedded allocated pension guarantees, lifetime annuities, and coming back to Michelle's earlier points, and the age pension, bearing in mind the interplay between the allocated pension and the age pension? Most fundamentally, in thinking about putting guaranteed benefits into allocated pensions, what form of guarantee will provide a sufficient proposition to actually recommend or to warrant recommending in light of, well, what's it going to do? Yes, it'll reduce the tail of adverse outcomes, but at the expense of potentially substantially reducing the median outcome, and perhaps more importantly, the guarantee fee will also reduce the likelihood of beating the survivor risk premium. I think there's a fair question to be asked there is, well, okay, it'll do stuff way out in the tail, but there's a whole range of outcomes more in the centre of the distribution where it'll have a very significant dent, certainly if the sort of fee levels that are being talked about, 75 basis points, 100 basis points, are realistic. Also fundamentally, the paper touched on, well, what then is the size of the market for those sorts of guarantees? If at the very small end there's a great big underpin from the age pension, admittedly it's not an immense income, but it is there as a continuing lifetime income stream. If that's there, it changes the risk profile of retirees with relatively small account balances. And at the very top end, well, if you're unlikely to burn through your allocated pension anyway,
you might not be too fussed about guaranteed minimum benefits. So there's perhaps a sweet spot in between, but how big is that sweet spot for guaranteed benefits in allocated pensions? Perhaps more fundamentally, though, do providers need better tools for assessing and promoting guaranteed benefits? Are the current level of fees an impediment today for allocated pensions if they're already at, I think we based ours on 175 basis points, 1.75% per annum fee, which is pretty typical of products out there at the moment. And what does, perhaps a throwaway thought, what does it imply for annuitised fund-type products, i.e. Asteron-type product designs, as to what their place is in the market and how they might be promoted? So just a few thoughts. I'll leave those up there. Happy to skip back to the advice slide earlier, if there are any points there that people wanted to recap. But that's the end of our pre-prepared material. Happy to take questions. I think we've got a roving mic. Or we'll turn that one into the roving mic and we'll answer questions from up here.
Okay, thank you, Duncan. Yes, so we'll throw over to questions now. If people can just state their name and speak into the mic. Ah, there is another microphone over there. So just pop your hand up if you'd like to ask a question.
Thank you. David Knox. It seems to me, Duncan and Michelle, firstly, thank you very much for the presentation. As you said, built on this morning's presentation well from Darren and Richard, but took it another step, I think, in a new direction. In terms of where you finished, Duncan, people with a small account balance perhaps should go high investment risk because they've got very little to lose. People with significant balances should go high investment risk because they can draw down what they need. Are we moving to a position where, in fact, account-based pensioners should be looking at a high-risk investment strategy? Because I noticed you looked at 30, 70 and 50, 50. What you didn't have up was 75, 25 or even 95, 5. And I'm just wondering whether we're moving to a position where our account-based pensioners at both ends, maybe there's a sweet spot in the middle, but at both ends, in fact, should be looking at much higher risk in their investment strategy.
I think it's a very fair question. The middle ground does seem to me to be the more obvious ground that guaranteed benefits might play to. Whether they're offering a benefit which, in the minds of the retiree, is perceived to be worth what the cost of them, I think the jury. Well, it'll remain to be seen. I'll be as interested as everyone else. We've certainly debated internally this point around relatively low account balances, and let me just skip back to it. That's the one we're talking about. That wasn't in the paper, but we thought we'd throw it in. This is 150,000 account balance, and a lot of the paper was driven off about a 350,000 account balance, deliberately so, because we're trying to go slightly further up market for the sort of reasons we talked about. But the stats are hard to come by, but the APRA stats, for what they're worth, seem to suggest about the average account balance in the retail sector for retirees might only be about 100,000, and that's 150. So we're already talking about well above average or typical retiree, and that conveys quite an interesting point. And we certainly debated from that, well, does it mean that it's almost a derivatives trader mindset of I've got my guaranteed underpin, I can go for my life here, because as an individual retiree with my allocated pension, I have asymmetric risk. I stand to win oodles on the upside if my bet pays off, and if I lose on the downside, I lose. Now, I know that's simplistic, but at the very least, it raises a question in my mind about the need for guaranteed benefits with an allocated pension for such low account balances. And don't forget, that's not that low. We did have if you pick higher income, because I'm not suggesting for a minute that's a comfortable living, we have based our income levels off the ASFA Westpac study. So this is this would be an income, a modest income for a single person. Is that right, Michelle?
The 150 was just selected basically so they could get the full age pension. So that was not really much,
but the income level we're targeting, 25,000, admittedly level. That's about what the ASFA study was suggesting as a modest income for a single person, and that is already using account balance that's quite a bit higher than average now. Sure, if someone is going to dial up their income level, it's going to look quite different from that. The account balance will run out. But if it's going to run out in 7, 8, 9, whatever number of years, I'm not sure that guaranteed minimum benefits are really going to do a tremendous amount for that individual, because I think, and Darren picked up this point very well this morning, because the actual distribution of when my fund runs out, when you're taking high income from a low fund balance, there's not a lot of investment risk in there. Most of it is just I'm drawing it down. I'm drawing it down as quickly as my or as slowly as my my standard of living, desired standard of living in retirement will allow me to. Any other questions?
Deb Jones, given that, notwithstanding the current divorce rate, a lot of people are still making joint income decisions about their retirement planning, one extension I wouldn't mind seeing to this is to see how an annuity with a reversion might compare to the allocated pension option.
I think just a contingent annuity would possibly lie somewhere in between those two SRP curves, where you've got the guarantee of the life expectancy and then the SRP without the life expectancy in there. So essentially, there are various... We actually also did another variation on the light blue line. That light blue line is, if from the paper, is guaranteed. The guarantee is set at age 60 and reduces 1 year each year, whereas you could take the approach that each year you reset that guarantee. So what is the life expectancy of, at 61, 2, et cetera? So there's various combinations and things that you could choose to do with that annuity, and those lines will be somewhere around there. But essentially... they do at some point generally cross over.
Yeah, there's lots and lots of permutations we can do. The paper was already at 60 pages, so we kind of figured we'd better stop there. But
Steve Schubert from Russell. First a comment for Darren and then a question for Michelle. Darren, Duncan. I've got Darren sitting next to me. Duncan, you've obviously never heard of industry funds, because I don't know how the industry's going to get away with 175 basis points on allocated pensions, but a hell of a lot of people have access to allocated pensions a lot cheaper than that, and I think that might have an impact on your findings. But Michelle, you talked about the gap between CPI and AWE growth that was implicit in your Social Security age pension indexation. Just seemed to me that does have a pretty profound effect on the results. I mean, over a 35-year period, essentially, it means your age pension is going to double, your Social Security age pension is going to double in real terms. And I know, you know, bringing Darren into the equation again, the Benefit Projections Task Force that he's been involved with have really looked at this issue as to what should be the deflator when you're presenting, future dollars, and reached a pretty strong conclusion that, in fact, AWE ought to be the deflator rather than CPI. One of the reasons being that, essentially over long periods of time, people's aspirations will grow in line with living standards as measured by wages growth rather than as measured by prices. Did you have a look at the... I mean, I know you flashed up one or two slides looking at that, but did you have a look at the sensitivity of it to that? It just does seem to be a pretty profound assumption.
You do definitely see there is more of a dip. If we go back a couple of slides, this is the total income where there is no gap between the indexation of the allocated pension and the indexation of, or the total income and the indexation of the age pension. Where they're both indexed to, say, AWE, you would actually still see that dip, because the only way that flattens out is when there's actually a gap between the two indexations. So I don't think we did actually do the both at AWE, but you get the same, or we may have, but essentially you get the same shape. So certainly to the point where we make about where's the longevity risk if there is a gap, certainly if there isn't a gap, and if the aspirations and the pensioner wants their total income to be indexed to a wage inflation index, then certainly they are going to, if they do run out of pension, they are going to see a change in their standard of living. So this chart essentially gives you that shape. Regardless of what you do, if you keep the indexation the same, you get this shape.
Steve York, Conrad Industry Funds. Yeah, this is. I don't have a particular axe to grind one way or another. I'm certainly conscious of the difference in fees. We really approach this from looking at the retail published statistics for retirement income streams, where I think the paper comments on this. It's about 84% weighting to allocated pensions versus about 16% to annuities, of which only a portion will be lifetime annuities. And the paper contrasts that, for those who've seen it, it's almost the exact opposite of that in, for example, the UK market. I think it's a bit under 80%, no, a bit less than that, about 70% lifetime annuities and only about 20% allocated pension equivalents. I think, well, what's going on here? The only observation that I'd offer you, and I kind of we choose our words fairly carefully in the paper, but it has been on a couple of slides. To my mind, product advice and product recommendations are for the advice process, and there'll be people who are more familiar with the detail of some of that than we will. The observation that I think we make in the paper is it's one thing to recommend an allocated pension. It's another thing to recommend an allocated pension and continue to recommend that with sort of a full discourse of some of the risks that are being implicitly assumed in taking on that allocated pension. And to the extent that there's recommendations given without sort of enough of enunciation of risk, to my mind, the AFS licensee is bearing that today. And it's not at all clear to me that they do, or at least from some that I've seen, that as good a job is being done as perhaps could be done in better conveying the risks to the retiree. Ultimately, it is still the retiree's decision, and they may well attach weight above everything else to flexibility and all the other things an allocated pension offers, and may continue to do that throughout retirement. But at least they're making those decisions fully informed, and they can't come back in 15 years' time when the funds ran out and say, I didn't understand the risk. And if I think about there are a litany of mis-selling events in the UK market, unfortunately. I'll ignore the granddad of them all, the pensions mis-selling. If you look at the next three biggest, of which the second biggest in the entire market, which is endowment mis-selling, I think last number I saw was about 2 years ago, and they were still counting at that point. The compensation was already above £2 billion. To my mind, and I have more than passing familiarity with this, given that I was there at the time, returns were disclosed, forecasts were given, sensitivities were given to individuals. What wasn't done was a comparison of choosing this product over the alternative, and also conveying, well, although I'm showing three sensitivities of outcomes to you, it didn't convey what the likelihood was of those outcomes. And so I'd say the thing that they've been pinged on, or at least one of the key things being pinged on, is about not enunciating risk well enough, as opposed to sort of conveying the product, conveying the returns from the product, conveying how those returns might vary. John.
Next question.
Margaret Cantwell.
Sorry.
Both in the discussions this morning and in the discussions now, one of the big underlying assumptions in these projections is continued mortality improvement. And I'd be interested in some comments you might have around cohort studies which are showing that while mortality improvement might be appropriate for people reaching retirement age now, it won't necessarily be appropriate for people in their 20s or younger. And it may mean that the advice that advisors are giving based on these sorts of models would be quite different for a 20-year-old than a 60-year-old.
Well, certainly the entire thrust of this is about people at retirement now, there's obviously been discussion earlier today around estimators or calculators, whatever you want to call them, for the accumulation stage. I guess there could be a paper even longer than 60 pages on what should the right mortality improvement factors be for work such as this. Yes, we've used a cohort mortality improvement basis. Others will have a different view. We're not hung up on the assumptions that we're using in here. I think the point was made. Yes, we've used, on the one hand, CPI for indexation, and on the other hand, as a proxy for AWE, CPI plus 2, another analysis in here showing CPI plus 1.5. Our motivation in the paper was to try and convey our concerns on one level, but also our ideas on another, not wedded to the particular assumptions that we're using, and happy if others want to use a different mortality improvement basis. I think it's a brave individual that projects out mortality improvements for 30 years, as a number of us have to do, let alone trying to do it for 80 years for the 20-year-old who's just starting their working career.
All I'd add to that is also we do, one of the things that we think is important is on an individual basis, you're not so much concerned about what the distribution is or how much improvement is in there. You're concerned for that individual, you know, what is their life expectancy? And obviously you have to have some way of coming up with the best estimate of that. But we do suggest asking them, you know, are you in good health or are you, you know, that kind of information. So one broad cohort of mortality improvement is not really, you know, where we think this should go.
Just one last question, John, in the interest of time.
Thank you. Duncan and Michelle, I found your paper very interesting, and I find the conclusion that that someone who takes out initially an allocated pension should nevertheless seriously consider switching into a guaranteed pension product, you know, after sort of 10 to 15 years of retirement. I find that has some intuitive appeal. But really, the thing that I think comes out that has really profound conclusions or implications out of your work is that you've done this really good stochastic work looking at, you know, probabilities that an allocated pension will, you know, run out after a certain length of time as a function of asset allocation. And I suspect that the financial advisory professions at the moment are focusing on the wrong sort of risk. You know, they're focusing on day-to-day volatility, and a lot of the advice that they'll give members of the public is that, you know, as you approach retirement age, you should have a more conservative, more prudent asset allocation, you know, to be more conservative. And yet, you know, what your work and also the earlier paper today really shows in a convincing way is that that's actually diabolically increasing the serious risk, which is the risk that your allocated pension will run out after a period of time. And to me, that's got incredibly important consequences, you know, from a social perspective, you know, that really the advisory profession should be getting people to sort of dial up that level of risk, and the sort of tools that you've developed and were shown in the earlier paper as well as, you know, important evidence, really sound justification for that sort of advice. Do you agree that really a big conclusion of what you've done is that asset allocation should be seriously reconsidered on a very widespread basis?
Yeah, we certainly do. We make the point, I think we kept coming back to it almost ad nauseum in the paper, that traditional measures of investment volatility, whether people prefer to look at that as, well, what's my volatility as traditionally defined, or is it X or 1 year out of eight that I might have a negative return, we kind of struggle with both of those. We think there are two key themes came out. Investment risk judged in terms of what is the risk of my funding being depleted at a point, at whatever age at which I can judge my likelihood of surviving to, but that fund depletion therefore equating to my income aspiration taking a hit from that point onwards. And then the second one, more from a product mix point of view, is the investment risk associated with staying in an allocated pension as opposed to doing something else. And the doing something else, yes, we've contrasted against lifetime annuity, but, you know, I'm not here intending to speak up that that's the only solution. But as soon as, if one's looking at the threshold that you have to beat year on year, if you stay in the allocated pension as climbing on you all the time, which is what happens, that's a very different proposition when it comes to thinking about investment risk. It's not an expected return and volatility around it. It's what's the likelihood actually that the bet that I'm placing this year by staying in my allocated pension is going to pay off for me this year. And as you can see, with age, that becomes harder and harder to achieve.
Okay, if everybody could join with me in thanking both Duncan and Michelle.